Hello, everyone, and welcome back to this audio conference training for rural grantees of the Office on Violence Against Women. My name is Liz Carlson, and I'll be your host for today's call. Today is part two of the series, What's in a Word? How Definitions of Violence Against Women and Children Shape Our Interventions. The topic for today's call is Intersections of Battering and Child Abuse. Ellen Pence will be our trainer again for today's session. So welcome, Ellen. You're with us, right?
Yes, I am, Liz.
Very good. Glad to hear you there. We hope that many of you were able to participate in yesterday's training, because today we'll build on that a bit, and Ellen will proceed with further information and cover specifically the intersections of battering and child abuse. We had about 160 people or so on the line yesterday, and we hope that we'll have as many participants today. A few people said that they had some problems with the volume, being able to hear Ellen. So we have increased the volume as much as we can on our end. If you find that you still are having trouble hearing, you can try to press star 4 on your keypad, and hopefully that will improve the volume for you on your end. Before Ellen begins, I'd like to remind you, if you haven't reviewed the electronic binder, it's still available on our website in the Rural TA pages. It contains Ellen's bio and the PowerPoint for today's discussion. In about 25 minutes, Ellen will be taking questions and comments. At that time, the operator will give directions for all of you about how to get into the question queue, so sit tight until that point. That's all for me, Ellen. Are you ready
to
roll?
Thank you very much, Liz. Right. And I will remind people that while OVW does, we are a contractor of OVW, the things that I say on this call are not necessarily the views of the Office on Violence Against Women. But the Office on Violence Against Women does want you all to be exposed to a lot of different speakers, a lot of different trainings, a lot of different ideas about this, and for but they oftentimes later on will say, now why did you say this or that? So I just want you to know, this is not the Office on Violence Against Women speaking. This is Praxis. So also I wanted to just say that after talking yesterday, I want to remind people that if you do this work, if you're a police officer and you want to really be good at doing domestic violence stuff, or you're an advocate or you're a prosecutor, anybody in the system, empathy is one of the things that you need to have, meaning the ability to put yourself in the shoes of another. So I want you to be empathetic right now towards me, and I'm going to ask you to, I want to actually open it up with a few comments that people might have or thoughts you might have left over from yesterday. So, Megan, I'm going to ask you to open the lines in a second here. And remember, be empathetic, because I'm sitting here on this phone. I have no idea what you all are thinking or what parts of yesterday were helpful and not so helpful. So I'm hoping that I'll get a few people that will get on the line and make some comments so I can get a little bit of a sense of where you're all at. If you do a training live, you know, you can look out and on this and see, you can see, oh, this person's not agreeing with anything, and this person's thinking this is stupid, and this person over here likes this. But when you do this on the phone, you just have no idea what is going out there in audience land. So I just would like to start out with having some people do a few little reactions to yesterday, things that you want to make sure that we address today, and or comments from yesterday, or questions about some of the concepts that were put out yesterday. So, Megan, let's open up the line.
All right. If you have a question or a comment, please press the number 1 once on your touchtone phone. All the questions and comments will be answered in the order that they are received.
And remember, empathy means that you put yourself in the shoes of another. Would you like to be sitting here as me and no one press number 1 and get on? No. So go ahead and press number 1 now. How many people, Megan? 18?
We have a couple.
Oh, good. Okay.
The first one comes from Jess in Oregon. Jess, your line is now open.
Thank you. Hi, Ellen.
Hi.
I just wanted to let you know that I appreciated the call yesterday, and I have used the publication Reexamining Battering to actually give a copy of the types of battery to clergy, to therapists that are in our area, so we're all operating from the same page and can increase that empathy.
Oh, okay, good. Thanks. And do you have any questions from yesterday?
No, I don't. I thought it was an excellent overview.
Okay, good, thanks. And that article that you're talking about, I think that you can, Liz, can people get that on our website?
Yes.
Yeah, Reexamining Battery, and there's an article on our website by Shamita Das Gupta and Ellen Pence, and it kind of gives a descriptor of those five categories that I talked about yesterday. Anyone else, Megan?
Yes, the next person is Linda in Arkansas. Linda, your line is now open.
I'm sorry.
Hi, Linda.
I'm sorry, we pushed the wrong button. We don't have a question. I'm sorry.
Oh, Linda, now you got to ask a question. You're online. There's 150 people listening to you.
Do you have a question? Yes.
Actually, Linda is not here. She's got us listening on the conference.
Okay, good.
Thank you.
Okay. Anyone else, Megan?
No, there are no further people in the queue at this time.
Okay. Yeah, that's pretty good. One caller and one accidental caller. Okay, so let's start with, on your slide 20, I think it's page 7 of, if yours printed out the way ours are, it's slide 20, page 7. We're getting on this focusing on battering now. And I might do a few repetitive things from yesterday, but I'll try not to be too repetitive. But I want to start on this slide that talks about what is unique about battering from other forms of domestic violence. And, of course, I think we all know that the intimate relationship that abusers have to victims in battering cases, because that the intention of battering is to establish control or dominance, and because it's the ongoing nature of it, it means that the abuser is able to do kind of two things at once. He's attacking her autonomy, because if we go back to this whole idea, Megan, do you hear a loud noise? Oh.
Yes, I didn't get a chance to see where it was coming from.
Oh, okay. If you go back to this idea of thinking about the triangle, and at the top of that triangle is the abuser, and at the bottom of that triangle is the victim. And so whether we're talking about groups or individuals, we have this notion that autonomy, individuals, whenever they're in oppressive situations, they always seek their freedom. They seek to get out of that. Whether we look at situations of, you know, as severe as slavery, as severe as, you know, very, very repressive regimes. You always see in countries that have very repressive regimes, the population, people in the population trying to burst out from underneath and resist that kind of repression. And so it's important for the person at the top of that triangle to attack any kind of autonomy people at the bottom have, because if they get too autonomous, too independent, then eventually they'll be able to see that triangle and say, I'm out of here, I don't want a part of this. And so there's a huge effort by the part of batterers or any group of people, but I'm particularly now I want to talk about batterers, to attack any kind of really autonomous moves on the part of the person that they're living with. And that means attempts to go back to school and get an education, attempts to be economically not necessarily free or independent of the, like a lot of women don't necessarily want to be independently, economically independent of their abuser, but they're looking to get a better job, they're looking to be able to support themselves and their family. And those things are always seen by the abuser as too much autonomy. And so you'll see that tons of women end up losing their jobs, not being able to finish school, because he's undermining all of that. So there's a promotion of victim dependency. And that promotion of victim dependency, if you go around that wheel, it happens on many, many levels. Like even a dependency to feel that if you want to feel good about yourself, it's going to come from him. Because, you know, lots of abusers will put down anything that's really building her up. You know, she'll say, you know, this happened at work, well, what do they know? You know, blah, blah, blah. And it's kind of a cut down of all that. But at the same time, he will build her up. So that if she is going to be built up, if she is going to feel good about herself, it's going to come through him. And so it's important to realize the not just the physical part of battering, but the kind of the the constant kind of mental part of battering. So that one of the things that you'll hear women talk about is being worn down, completely worn down. And when they're worn down on this mental level of resisting not just the violence and him hitting her and things like that, but this constant, constant thing about, you're not doing this right, you're not any good, you're this, you're this, you're this. And so that eventually a lot of women just feel it's just easier to submit. And the resistance gets kind of knocked out of them. And so oftentimes you'll see women much more resistant in early phases of the relationship, less resistance as time goes on. And then as she starts to make that decision of getting out, or maybe she's made the decision to get out years before, but as she actually starts to be able to take the actions to get out, some of that resistance comes back in. But the important thing about resistance in those triangles is always met by people at the top with a tremendous amount of retaliation and I'm going to take things away from you. So when we're saying to women, get out, get out, get out, you know, you got to get a protection or you got to do this, you got to get out, we have to remember that what you're saying to her is you've reached some kind of a relationship with him that you understand, that on some level you're managing. We're telling you to do something that is going to increase all of the danger to you and increase in the intensity of the abuse that you're experiencing. It is not going to end it. It's going to shift where you're living. But very few batterers simply let women walk out. So I think that's the really important thing to remember. And people will make this list of, well, why do women stay? Because of the kids, because of economics, because of school. But it's so much deeper than that. It's so much, the totality of it is so much stronger than what that list ever conveys to people. So one of the things that we have to think about is that batterers, you can never say that they all do this or anything like that, because this all happens so differently depending on economics, on cultural backgrounds, on people's personal histories. But generally speaking, in different ways, batterers tend to want victims and push victims to act on the behalf of the batterer. They want them to think and behave in their interest. So even in the relationship before they start to split up or anything like that, many of us on the phone get involved in these cases during the split up or as she's thinking about getting out, whether it's police or once the police start getting involved and the courts start getting involved and shelters start getting involved and mental health people start getting involved, that's usually an indication that people are reaching out or going outside of family forms of resolution, negotiation, getting the family involved, out into getting other people involved. And that's usually the beginning stages of people actually thinking about leaving the relationship or getting out of the relationship. And as they do that, batterers have tended all along to get the victim to act on their behalf. From just the daily living things about how he wants his coffee and how he wants this and how he wants that, to the idea of, you disrespected me in front of my brother, to the idea of, you know, I don't want them in the house. So much of battering is getting her to think about what he needs and what he wants and what his desires are and meeting those. That's around sex, that's around who's around the house, that's around how the kids behave. I don't want the kids in the living room when I'm here. I don't want this, I don't want that. So a lot of the relationship has been him getting her to act on his behalf. And so when she starts to act on her behalf or on the behalf of the children in her in opposition to what he wants, it's experienced by the abuser as betrayal. And again, I want to say that this isn't just men lying or being deceptive or things like that. They actually experience her as betraying them because they've established her in her head of she exists on some level for him. He's doing this. He sees himself as there being her protector. He's the person who's the head of the household. He's the person who's doing this. And her duty and her obligation is to do this, this, and this. And when she starts to be act in autonomous ways, she starts to say to him, I'm leaving, or I'm not doing this, or I'm not doing this anymore, and not acting based on what he wants, the sense of betrayal in him is very, very strong, and that makes batterers more dangerous. That's the thing that we have to kind of recognize, is that what makes him or her more dangerous is not that he was always like this and he's going to do this, but his sense that he's going to lose this and that she's doing this to him. You know, you don't hear women say, who is he to do this to me? You do hear women mad that he had an affair or mad that he did this or mad that he did that, but they don't have this notion that whenever you have a group that thinks that they're superior to another group and this group that they're superior to starts to fight back and move outside of them, the idea is you're looking down at them and say, well, who are you to reject me? If anyone should be doing the rejection, it's me rejecting you. And so there's an added sense of not only betrayal, but who are you to do this to me? And you'll hear that in if you're working in a visitation center, if you're working in the courts, and you're listening carefully to how the men are talking about this. And it's not just that they feel like they're victims of the person they're victimizing, but they experience themselves as men, on many, many levels of she's done something to him, to get him, after him, et cetera, et cetera. So another thing that that abusers do then is they do punish a lot when she's not appeasing, because a major strategy of women living with abusers is to appease, to appease, to appease. If you don't appease, then there's going to be violence, there's going to be some kind of, you know, negative thing towards the kids, towards her mother, towards, you know, her work situation or whatever. So there's a lot of appeasement that goes on by women in battering situations, and when she doesn't appease, there's a lot of punishment that goes on. So one of the things that batterers will do as women are, I'm talking now about the separation process, is that then they'll go outside of the intimacy of the relationship and the family, because now she's going outside. Now his abuse has to go outside. And as his abuse goes outside, here's some of the major tactics that they'll use. One is that they will say she's mentally ill. She's not emotionally stable. Now, you would think living with him all this time would maybe make somebody not very emotionally stable, and that's fairly true. So when he's pointing out things about her behavior that shows that she's mentally ill, people are going, she did that. She's gone 3 or 4 times to her mother's house to live. She's done this. She's done that. So if her behavior appears, if he can make her behavior look erratic in any way that he can document, then he's trying to convince a CPS worker, a visitation center worker, a protection order judge, a probation officer, this woman is a nutcase. And he's got this lineup of things that's going to prove that she is. Now, it's important to see that this is a major tactic, because how the woman then will present herself will sometimes reinforce his claim that she is. And I'll talk about that later when I talk a little bit about how women then come into the system. So he's trying to convince people that she's mentally ill, she's emotionally unstable. Look, she's going to a therapist, she's bipolar, she's on drugs for this, she's on drugs for that. And this is where I'm saying that individual men's violence is structurally, it's structurally supported in that many, many women who go into mental health centers, because they're being battered, because of the pressures of what it's like to live with an abuser, she may not identify that this is the source of all of her anxiety, of her depression, of her inability to cope, of her inability to deal with her kids. Whatever kind of reason she seeks out therapy or help, she's not going to necessarily always say, I need help because I'm losing my mind because I'm living with a guy who's battering me. It's not necessarily that clear to her that that's what all of this stuff that's going on with her is happening. He's telling her she's nuts. She's feeling nuts. In some ways, she's going along with what he's saying. Sometimes some women are. So if she's been in therapy, or if she's been to a psychiatrist, or if she's gotten on some kind of anti-anxiety pills, those are the very things that he uses to show the cop who walks in the door she's mentally ill. And then the officer says, are you on your meds? And she says, no, I didn't take my meds today. Well, now we're dealing with a woman with mental health problems. We're not dealing with a batterer and the person that he's battering. We're dealing with a woman with mental health problems. The guy can't quite cope. So you see how this shift happens very quickly, and it happens over and over and over again in the system. You'll see this a lot in the divorce and custody kind of proceedings. So people who are operating visitation centers will particularly see a lot of women literally visiting their kids in the visitation center because he's very successfully been able to say, she's not stable, I am, the kids need this stability, give the kids to me. And so now she's visiting these children in a visitation center, and oftentimes the significant amount of what the problem was in the beginning was his violence. So I wanted to say that this major tactic is one that we all have to be highly tuned into. The notion that she's mentally ill, that she's unstable, and that because of her instability, that is the source of the problem, and that's what we should be paying attention to. It's a major, nice, what they call in bridge, jump shift. He's shifted and jumped over to another thing and gotten us looking where we, not at what we should be looking at, but looking at the result of the problem rather than the cause of the problem. The next thing that happens is that once there's a claim of mental illness that has any legitimacy, that the police officer comes out and she's not on her meds, that goes into the police file, and that sticks to her like glue. And it keeps getting added onto. Next thing you know, she's into the thing, and they send her off for a psych eval. Now, I'm going to make this statistic up. You know, they say that, 47.2% of all statistics are made up on the spot, and this is going to be one of them. 83.9% of all psych evals that are done in the United States are done without any domestic violence context being done first. So in other words, if I were to do a psych eval of a woman coming in to me who's being battered, who's been sexually abused, whose husband is now saying after 7 years of telling her, you ever leave me, I will take those kids away from you. I swear to God you will not see your kids again. No judge is going to give you custody of those kids. All that kind of pressure. Now she's sitting in front of someone who's going to do a psych eval of her with that going on and on and on in her head. She's emotionally unstable. She's a wreck. She's depressed. This person starts to do little tests on her, and she's thinking, I'm failing this test, I'm failing this test. And she literally melts down sometimes in front of the psychiatrist or psychologist. And in doing so, she reasserts this notion that her mental illness is the problem. And what you don't find, and this is what I would say would be a recommendation that we should all do, it should be a requirement that whenever there's domestic violence, a thorough assessment of the domestic violence occur before the psych eval, and that whole assessment of domestic violence, what went on, what kind of violence went on, how it was happening, how the kids were drawn into it, then the psych eval is done to show the connection between what the psych reports are showing, what the tests are showing, and the violence that has occurred. But when you erase the violence and you just show the test results, usually batterers are going to test out more stable than battered women. And so this is going to actually be used against them in court. They look on many, many psychological tests, the batterer looks better than the victim of battering. And that's not that hard to comprehend or understand why that might happen. But it doesn't get presented that way in court. It just gets presented as, look at his psych eval next to hers. So this notion of mental illness, her being crazy, it keeps getting blown out bigger and bigger and bigger, and it never gets seen as really, when you look at her mental condition, it oftentimes is a direct result of the violence and sexual abuse that she's experienced. The next thing is that batterers tend to draw their children into the abuse of their mothers. This is something I'm going to talk about in great detail in a few minutes. But it's not, in stranger assaults, for example, you don't have this drawing children into it. But there, I want to go through this later, so I think I'll skip that right now. And say that it's important that if you're living with a person and you're trying to control them and they leave you, you got to sit back and think, okay, I can't do this, I can't do this, I can't do this. These were the ways that I had control before, and now I don't, I'm not living every day. I can't see where she is. I'm not talking to her every day. The desire, not the desire, but the need to control and the attempts to maintain control, to either to get her to come back, to punish her, to get the kids, whatever the goal now of the abuser is as she walks away. And remember, for some abusers, she's going to walk away and they're going to let go and say, it's over. And they're not going to pursue, they're not going to stalk, they're not going to break protection orders, they're not going to say, I'm not going to let you go, they're not going to punish her. It's rare that there's going to be no form of punishment, but not all abusers do this pursuit. You know, once a woman decides she's going to leave and she gets a protection order, she files for divorce, he may not like it, but he doesn't physically make her come back or punish her for doing this. Other batterers will punish her for literally for years and years and years. And to the very extreme that some batterers will kill. Some batterers will kill her children and not her as a way of punishment. So you have this very, very wide continuum here that I would say, again, I'm going to make up the statistic, but maybe a fourth of batterers sort of let her go with minimal amount of harassment. And 75% are going to do some kind of harassment, and a significant number of them are going to do fairly serious damage to her. And those are often the cases that many of us are involved in. Those of us who are on the phone are on the phone because we're handling those cases that often tends to be the worst cases or keep moving along the continuum of severity. And so there's a shifting of tactics with abusers, and that shift goes from, I'm going to have my tactics be directly towards you and your mother and this and that, to my tactics are going to be to draw institutions that you turn to for help into the process of keeping me where I'm at. And also I'm going to use the power that I have over you to shield me from any kind of intervention. So if you think of here he is standing right here in front of you, and he's going to grab her and put her in between you and him so that he uses the power that he has over her to shield him from any kind of confrontation by police, the courts, prosecution. And an example of that is women will say, I won't testify. I'm not going to get on the stand and testify. And we go, oh, my God, she's in denial. What good is it going to do her to testify against him if he is going to get 10 days in jail? How is that possibly going to help her? So she's looking at this as, if I testify against him in court, he will not forgive me. He will not let go of this for years. The prosecutor is looking at this, I can't get a conviction unless I get her to testify. I can't get this or I can't get that. But what is it going to do for her? Get him in a 27-week program, which, you know, some work and some don't. Is it going to get her, What is it going to get her to testify? So a lot of women aren't necessarily in denial when they don't testify. They're weighing up of what possible good is this for me and my kids against what it's going to bring me. And if she wants to stay with him, it's going to bring a lot of hassle. If she wants to separate from him, it's going to bring a lot of hassle. So I think we need to think a little bit differently sometimes when we see women not so-called cooperating or participating with the system. It's not necessarily that she's not trying to get her needs met. It's oftentimes that what it is that we have the ability to do at that moment is going to turn against her. So the next thing I want to talk about a little bit is about when victims get drawn into institutional processes like these, there's certain things that we can look for and see. And, you know, I always read this stuff about, oh, victims do this and victims do that and abusers do this and abusers do that. And no matter what I hear people say, I think, well, I don't agree with that because I know this case or that case. So I really don't want people to take it that this happens all the time. But I think you should be smart about these things that I'm talking about. You should be alerted to the fact that they're going to be in cases that you deal with. And if they're in those cases and you understand how it's working, you can be more helpful. I don't like talking about this stuff the way I'm talking about it, but on the other hand, I think it's helpful to just be alerted without putting this over every case you have and thinking that you see it in every single case. So one of the things I'll start out by saying is that many, many times a victim of domestic abuse will come into the system in some way, and she is not going to believe that you believe her. She's not going to believe that you understand what's going on, and she's not going to believe that you understand the nuances of what it is that's going on. Now, that's partly true because, that's partly the case because it's true. A lot of people don't necessarily believe her. A lot of people are really trained not to believe one person over the other, but to look for and investigate to see what happened. So when you start to, when she's all beat up and she comes in and you say, can you tell me what happened? I'm a police officer now. Can you tell me what happened here tonight, ma'am? And she's saying, he beat me up. And then she's looking at him and she's got this cut here and she's got this cut there. And you know, he's got a bite mark on his shoulder. And he says, look at here, she bit me, she bit me. And then he's saying, can I see that bite mark? And he's taking a picture of the bite mark, and she's going, oh, my God, he's going to convince her that I did this biting. I mean, he had a hold of me. Of course I bit him. And the police officer can't turn to her and say, ma'am, we understand that this is a defensive wound, but we're just talking to him anyways. They just carry on their investigation, and she's thinking, he doesn't believe a thing I'm saying. And then she's getting agitated, and she's thinking, of course, it's another man, or it's a cop, or it's the system, and he's going to, you know, he's going to get them thinking this way. And so oftentimes you'll see women kind of escalating in their anxiety with you and in their hostility towards you as an outside intervener. And I'm talking particularly here to, like, police officers and even sometimes 911 operators, that you'll see a real woman turning on you because you believe his stuff. You don't believe me. And this is so much a part of the battering situation in the first place. I mean, he has said this to her over and over. I remember one time when I went on a domestic with a police officer, and he dialed 911 and handed her the phone. Now, this is way back in 1980. Okay, you can tell how old this I am, and this is the very first week of mandatory arrest in Duluth, which was the first city to do mandatory arrest. And we went out on this call, and it came out in the thing that he said, what are you doing arresting me? And he couldn't believe that the police were arresting him, because the police had been there a million times before. And he was so confident that the police wouldn't do anything that he dialed 911 and handed her the phone after he had beaten her up. And all of a sudden he was less confident about that. I don't think he ever did that again. But there is this thing that goes on where he's saying, do you think anyone's going to help you? And he's told her over and over people won't believe her. He's told people she's nuts. And so this is a very big thing. How do you as an intervener get her trust? And so there's a lot of techniques that people use, like police officers should separate. And they don't just separate, put him here and her 5 feet away so he hears everything you're saying to her. You have to separate them. And even if you're trying to get an account, the very first thing you have to say is, we're here to help you. We're here to protect you. We need to know from your point of view everything that's happened tonight so we can help you. When you say something like that, she's going, wait a minute. I mean, she can calm down a little bit. You're saying, we're here to help you. That is not, I mean, I've seen police officers do that, and they immediately get her cooperation because they've established this notion of partnership with her. They're still there to investigate the crime scene, but they make it very clear to her, you know, don't worry about what he's saying. You know, he could be saying all sorts of things, but I'm here to help you, and I want to make sure you're safe tonight, and I want to make sure your kids are safe tonight. That doesn't mean that he's not going to be objective and do an investigation. He's telling her the truth. I want to make sure you're safe and your kids are safe tonight. And so just tell me, let's go through this really, really slowly. What happened tonight? Just let's go through your story. And so when you approach her that way, it takes away that idea, he's not going to believe me. So I'm just using this one example for the police, but every single person that encounters her, if they can figure out a way of establishing a partnership with her right away. I've also seen this with child protection workers, where many, many child protection workers will come in and say, if your kids are observing this violence over and over again, that's a form of neglect. You've got to get him out of the house. You need to get a protection order. And they're telling her what she needs to do, and they're being fairly kind of directive. You have to do this, and you have to do this, or else I'm going to have to take the kids out. And that's how they talk with her. They may do it nicely, but they're still doing this talking to her. There's a woman that I just interviewed recently, and she said that her child protection worker came in, and first she described herself as really a horrible client, that she was telling everybody, you can't tell me what I'm going to do with my kids, and you can't do this, and you can't do that. And then she said, I got assigned this worker, and the first thing she said, I was crying, and I said, they took my babies away, they took my babies away, how am I going to get my babies back? And she sat down, and she said to me, there's only one person on this earth that can help you get those babies back, that can get those babies back. And she said, "Who? How can I do this?" And the worker said to her, "You can do it. I know how you can do it. I can help you do it, but you've got to do certain things. And if you do those and I can help you, I can show you how, I can help you do them. I can't do them. You have to, but then you can get your kids back." And so she had a way of talking to her that immediately put her in partnership with this woman. And if you ever get a chance to see this video, Liz will have it, you know, in a couple months, because we're just editing these videos. But this woman is describing herself as kind of the nightmare client. And this worker turned that around in 15 seconds by having a way of looking at her and number one, not judging her, but believing somewhat, look, you can do this, and I can help you, and we can do it together. So I would say that the two main things that women look for in reaching out to the system for help, or even having the system impose their help on her, is this person judging me, and is this person in partnership with me, or are they going to tell me what to do and force me, like him, to do something that I'm not willing, able, ready to do the way they want me to do it. So that's the most practical advice I can give you. I'm going to talk a little bit later about how to do some of these things. But making this partnership and reducing this notion of judgment is the main thing you can do to link up in an engaged way with battered women that will make your job 10 times easier.
Ellen,
yes?
What do you think about stopping for questions?
Let me do two more things about women's responses, and then I'll stop and ask for questions, okay?
Okay.
The next one I want to say is that besides that she doesn't believe that the intervener is going to believe her, the next one is that she frequently has a very difficult time articulating everything that's going on. And the reason for that is the person who's coming in doesn't even ask her, tell me everything that's important to know here. The person who's coming in says, tell me what's important for me to know to process the case the way I process it. So a police officer wants one piece of information, a CPS worker wants a different one, a shelter worker wants a different one. Everyone who's coming into her life wants to know, let's say there's 42 pieces of information that are important. Each one of us wants these three or these six or these seven. We're not interested in the other 35 pieces of information. So the first reason she has a hard time articulating what it is she has to say is because all of this really matters, but to you, the police officer, or you, the 911 caller, or you, the shelter worker, you're only interested in this or that. She doesn't have a way of distinguishing all those things, why you're only interested in this or this or this. The second reason is that practitioners are trained to treat people kind of like data points. So I go in and I say to a woman, tell me this, like what happened tonight, what did he hit you with, did he hit you with a closed hand or an open fist? If I'm a shelter worker, I'll say, how many kids do you have with you, is this abuse imminent, you know, I want to know, is she in immediate danger that she would be eligible for our services? So we're asking her a bunch of questions that tells us what to do with her. And the framework for this conversation between us and her is what we need to know to do our function, and it's what's relevant to us. And she becomes a data point where we ask her questions. Sometimes we even decide on her risk by asking her questions, not really having a dialogue with her, but has he ever killed a pet? Has he ever done this? Has he ever choked or strangled you? Have you made attempts to leave in the past? Has he ever threatened suicide? And when we get these 17 questions answered, we say, oh, her risk level is this. We don't sit down and ask her, what do you think? How dangerous do you think he is? We treat her as a data point, and we're trained to do that. And so some of the reasons that women have a hard time articulating to us is partly the way we're organized to listen, to talk to her, to gather information, to make sense of that, and then to help act with her towards what would make her safe. So I wanted to make a couple of those points, the notion of believing, the notion of helping women articulate their stories. There's a lot of other reasons why they can't articulate their stories, but now I think I'm taking too much time on that. The other thing that's important about women is that they have different priorities than the system does. The system, any person from the system is coming in to process her as a particular kind of case, a criminal case, a CPS case, a landlord case, whatever. She's looking at her life like, I need all of this, and she's not so interested in your thing of getting a conviction or the narrow way that child protection might look at protection. She's got a whole range of things she's looking for, and very few of us are able to come in and look at that whole range with her and help her move in a direction that's going to help her. So all of these factors make it so there's a disconnect oftentimes between us, the helpers, and she, the person that we're trying to help and protect. And so I'll just stop there for a couple of minutes and then ask, while people are lining up on the queue, if anyone has questions, press 1. And Beth or Marn, if you have a question, you can ask it now.
Hi, Ellen. It's Beth.
Hi, Beth.
Hi, Beth. So while people are getting organized and asking you questions, I thought maybe you could talk a little bit about how communities now come together with this recognition that, you know, you said yesterday that when we talk about domestic violence, we're not all talking about the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So is there a way that you can suggest people move forward in their communities to bring this up and start to have this conversation so that we all are talking about the same thing?
One of the things I would say is, and I'll answer this a little bit more later at the end when I'm giving practical solutions, but I think that, to me, I'm doing this project right now in St. Paul where we're trying to do it. We have this project in which all of the agency heads have agreed to 6 main goals in reforming our criminal justice system's response to domestic violence, and one of them is to make the intervention match the risk. And to do that, we have to kind of determine the risk, which means we determine the kind of violence going on and we determine the level of it. Those two things kind of go together in order to figure out the risk. And then once we've determined that it's a high risk situation, it's a medium risk situation, it's perhaps a low risk situation, then we adjust the intervention to those levels of risk. And if people are interested in this kind of concept, we can, again, I'll have to tell you that it's more towards the end of the summer or early fall that we'll have our first kinds of pieces of information out there. But basically what we're going to try to do is set up a documentary system where everyone is looking for the same kind of things and engaging in dialogue with victims and perpetrators in a way that gives us a more, if I could say, nuanced information. So we're not just asking, did he ever kill a pet? But, you know, did he kill a pet because it had cancer and it was dying? Or did he kill a pet as a way of threatening to kill you? Or did he kill a pet because you liked that pet and he wanted to hurt you? Those are 3 very different things, and there are different levels of risk that are associated with each of those. So we're trying to do that in St. Paul now, is to figure out how do you kind of get the information going from the dispatcher all the way through, so that you're starting to collect information so you can really get a read on a case. this is a lot easier to do in a rural area than it is in an urban area. And then once you've got levels of risk, then you automatically, at every point of intervention, you have elevated emergency and standard reactions, so that you're not lumping everything together. And I can't really go into a lot more detail about that because it's kind of complicated on many levels, but at the end I'm going to give an example, just for example, in charging decisions, how to do that. Anybody in the queue, Megan?
Yes, the first question comes from Renee in Nebraska. Renee, your line is now open.
Hi, Renee.
Hi, how are you? I'm just wondering how we have some difficulties getting our police on board here in town, and just wondering if you have any strategies for that.
For getting the police on board to?
To just really actually even contact us sometimes.
I see, yeah, okay. Well, I'll tell you, sometimes, you know, there's a relationship between an advocacy program and police that from things that happened many years ago, it's still hostile or it's not nice, it's not friendly. I think that from the beginning, advocacy programs should start with not trying to change what the police do initially, but understand what the police do. And so my recommendation always is that you start out by doing ride-alongs, a lot of ride-alongs, and you have all your staff do ride-alongs and say, we need to understand, you know, how things work. And if you can get a ride-along program going for your staff or a few key members of your staff, a few board members, they will end up thinking, these people maybe know a few things because they've been in the squad car with us. It's really very few advocacy programs would ever call the police up and say, will you come and train us on how to be better advocates? We might say, can you come and train us on how to do security or how to do this or that? But we wouldn't say, come and train us on how to be better advocates, because we don't think they know anything about advocacy. And so partly the problem is that we kind of knock on their door saying, not just that we're here to help, but we're here to change. Remember, we're saying we're here to change what you do. And so then it's just going to open up that door, because they don't, I mean, if I can just put this bluntly, they don't think you know what the heck you're talking about sometimes. So the way to me that police open up their door is if, number one, they're forced to by legislation or something like that, but the other one is that they think that people understand what it is that they do and won't really attack them. One of the interesting things about police is that they're the most gone after professions by the media. And so people are always looking for the police didn't do this or the police didn't do that, the police should have done this better, the police should have done that better. So they're very, very kind of like they got boxer brain about some of this stuff because they've been hit so many times with the police should have done things differently. And at the doorstep of the police is every ill of society. And so one of the things is recognizing that kind of the natural defensiveness that's going to be there is figuring out ways that you can say, you know, can we start to have some communication? I mean, I don't want to say it that way. That sounds too kind of. But to me, it's doing ride-alongs. It's talking to people. It's having, you know, when I first started working with the Duluth police, which is where I did most of my work, I started out by going out to lunch with certain people that I thought I could say what's going on and what's the best way for us to approach the police department, how should we do this, how should we do that, and getting advice from people that I did have contacts with, and they are the ones that opened up doors, and I can kind of arrange a meeting with you and the lieutenant. The lieutenant, I can arrange a meeting with you and the chief. You want to find those openings, and I always say look for the door that you can walk through. If it's not the chief's door, it's going to be somebody's there. And if nothing else, start with, if they have a ride-along program, start to do it. And you'll see that the more they see that you know about what they do, the more they'll listen to you.
Great. Thank you.
Okay.
There is another question in the queue. It comes from Bola in New Hampshire. Bola, your line is now open.
Oh, thank you. Talking of the justice system, I know that emotional or mental abuse is not recognized for, you know, for granting restraining order to victims. Would that be part of what you will be working on?
Well, I'll tell you, if, this is going to sound terrible, but if we opened up the door to emotional abuse being a reason to get somebody out of the house, men would be kicking us women out all the time, because they'll go in and claim emotion. You know, emotional abuse is a really huge door, and if we don't, I don't think we want judges sitting there deciding if we hurt his feelings or if we were emotionally abusive to him. And it's a very different thing than what you're talking about. I'm sure what you're talking about is these extreme forms of tearing a person down and making them almost ill from the kind of treatment they're getting. But I think most of us are very reluctant to try to open up that door for a reason for a protection order, because it'll be used against so many women. You know, just in, as a society, we oftentimes will say things men do with their fist what women do with their mouths. And so there's this stereotype of women, this image of women as tearing men down and emotionally hurting them and doing these things, and then men are more physical towards women. And so that would work really, it would really backfire on so many women. So we've been very reluctant to do that. I did work in the Marine Corps for about 5 years, and we did have a form of abuse called extreme emotional abuse, but we were very clear in spelling out aspects that that would mean, like imprisonment kind of things, where you don't let a person out of the house, where you don't let a person, a lot of Marines would, not a lot, but many Marines would marry women from other countries, have them come over here, and never let them learn English. And then not let them form relationships. So we spelled out really clearly what that meant, and that worked kind of in the Marine Corps setting, because you had a more contained way of enforcing it, and we had very specific things that we said constituted extreme emotional abuse. We put that word in. That's the only place that I've seen it work where I thought it it didn't backfire much on women.
Well, it's kind of very frustrating, because most of the women I've worked with, they talk so much about the emotional abuse and how people could see the scar from the black and blues, the physical abuse, but the, you know, torture they have in their soul, at times resulting to mental illness. And this is still not recognized by the society. That's why I actually brought it up.
Well, no, I think a lot of people are, I mean, a lot of battered women will say the emotional abuse was much worse than the physical. And so people do look for remedies for that. But if we start to give the state permission to exclude people from their homes for emotional abuse, the chances are that that will work very, very much. It would be very hard to keep it in a contained way that would be used the way you want it to be used. And sometimes that would be like, sometimes whole family members will gang up on one person, a man or a woman, and and it makes their life absolutely hell. And you're right, someone should step in and protect, but there's a real problem with doing that through the protection order process or the criminal process of criminalizing emotional abuse. So I'm not very useful to you, am I? Anyone else?
No, there are no further questions in the queue at this time.
So, so let me just go on then. From my, I think we talked about the key things I wanted to say about victims that are drawn into institutional processes is that they look for partnerships from helpers. They have strong antennas for judgment. They have limited knowledge of what each piece of the complex apparatus we're involved in does. They face real obstacles for justice, because justice is different than what all of us are doing. Justice is kind of this notion of, maybe I'll say that there's kind of three elements to justice. Justice corrects a wrong. Justice makes the truth visible. And justice tries to repair the harm that's done to a person that's been wronged. And if we look at those three elements of justice, that's not necessarily what goes on in protection order court or in criminal court or, it is the criminal and civil justice system, but justice isn't necessarily the goal or the result of what people are looking for. As we process cases, we look for very certain kind of results. So there's a lot of obstacles that women face for those three things, of making visible what's really going on in the truth, of actually correcting the wrong that's happening to them, and then of repairing the damage that's been done by what's gone on. And so we need to kind of see that that's what she's looking for. She's looking for justice. She's not looking for a conviction of this. She's looking for justice. And we have to try to make the collective response of the justice system and the human service system and those in our communities somehow come together to reach justice. And then finally, I just want to reiterate this thing I said earlier about the system looks for cooperation from people. And it's very easy to make victims of ongoing kind of mental, emotional, and physical and sexual abuse appear to be and look to be uncooperative. And so when cooperation becomes kind of a condition of protection, you end up with a lot of it backfiring in a lot of women. So I want to just kind of warn us about, like, the child protection system is very cooperation kind of driven. And when people aren't seen as cooperating, they oftentimes either lose their kids or don't get them back. Even the cooperation itself is no sign of whether or not a person changed. So that's kind of a big thing to talk about, but I just want people to think about that a little bit, that when you're saying that your protection is tied to your cooperation, and then you look at the situation that victims are in, they're not going to look cooperative in many, many ways to the system. And because we have that kind of condition for the help that they get, then we're going to end up failing to help a lot of people that need it, because we're going to label them as being uncooperative, when in fact something really quite different is going on oftentimes. So I want to go into, I have this section next about what this means for interventions, but I'm going to do that after I talk about children. Because I want to talk right now about, we've talked about these different kinds of violence. We've talked about what abusers tend to do. We've talked about some of the responses of victims. But now I want to say that in almost always, if children are involved, maybe I'll just put it this way, if children are involved, then children are involved. And if you're living with a batterer as a child, I just want to take two words and say, let's get them out of our language. And that is that children witness violence and children are exposed to violence. If you live with a batterer, you're not simply witnessing what is going on. And you're exposed to, you witness something happens that's outside of you. But when your mother gets hit by your father, and you're standing there, and you're looking at your mother get hit by your father, you do something. You either step in and you help your mother, you hide, you run and get help. Children always do something. And what they do is something that they mull over in their heads over and over and over. I should have done this. I should have done this. I should have done this. I know for people that I know, they think back at times when their mother was getting abused 30 years later and think, I should have done this. The point that I'm making is they weren't simply observing. They were drawn into this. And by their lack of action or their action or how they responded or what they did, they have a sense of responsibility and participation in it. Most abusers actually literally bring their children into the abuse of their mother in many ways. And that's the thing that we have to recognize and get smart about and see when it's happening. So I want to turn to part two now. And which side are we on now, Liz? It's part, which says context is everything, part two.
Yep. We are on page 9.
And what slide?
I don't know. I'm not sure, Ellen. Page 9 for the binder.
For the binders, okay.
Yep.
Okay, so if you go to page 9 of your binders, I'm going to talk about a little bit. In the child protection world, if you were to take 100 child protection cases and read the whole file, you'll find that those cases break down into 7 basic forms of child abuse. The first one is parental irresponsibility, where parents are like 15, 16, 17, 18 years old, and they go out partying, they leave the children behind. Unfortunately, some people even older do that. But there's just a lot of stuff that falls in this category of just parents not being responsible, not being ready yet to say, now there is a child in my life and I can't do the things I used to do. The next category that you'll find in these child protection cases is where the assessment of the worker and of the child protection system is that they lack the skills, the basic skills to feed their children, to dress their children, so they're not, you know, the children are not only being underfed because of a lack of food, but they're just not feeding them the right things. They have really poor nutritional kinds of things going on, and the child is losing weight, not sustaining itself, not growing at the rate that it should, and then the hospital gets involved, calls child protection. So there's a whole lack of skill section that or group of people. The next one is the lack of capacity to raise your children because of poverty, because of the housing system that they're in, because the person might have 2 jobs and they have no child care. Person with significant disabilities that can't raise their child without help and they don't have that help. All those things become neglect cases. If the parent can't raise the child for whatever reason, the state steps in and says, then we're going to have to. And so they're always investigating. Can the parent do it? Can we put them in the position of doing it? Or does the state have to come in? That's the basic question of every child protection worker. Can this parent do this? If not, do we need to? And so capacity is a very big issue. The next one is parental cruelty. And these are the cases that you hear about in the media where a child is locked up or a child is chained to something. A child is treated like an animal, is raised in a barn. These horrible, horrible stories of cruelty. And they will be on a huge continuum. But those are rare, but they're the ones that get lots and lots of media attention. The next one is excessive control and dominance, where a parent is constantly disciplining a child or disciplining a child too harshly, leaving marks, using a belt, thinking that they're being strict with this child, but in fact, you know, being excessively violent and excessively controlling with a child. Now, many of us, myself included, don't think you should use violence against a child in order to discipline them. But the state, most states, I think every state in the United States, says that a parent has the right to physically discipline their child. And so this is when they go outside of the boundaries of what the state allows. So they're leaving marks, et cetera, et cetera. The next thing that you can see in child protection files is what the conclusion is of the investigation is that the parents have too much stress, and the stress is making them neglectful of their children or making them hit their children. So this is stress sometimes from child rearing itself. A single mother with 4 kids, and it's just she cannot cope with all the stress, and she starts hitting the kids or being neglectful, etc. Conflicts in home, economic instability, there's a lot of things, homelessness, that cause stress with parents that then eventually can lead to either the physical abuse of children or the neglect of children. Next is, the last one I'm going to say is pathology, where alcoholism, drug abuse, mental illness, brain trauma, all those things make it so that a parent is either neglectful or abusive to their child. And so these are the kinds of basic, if you were to look at all the things that child protection looks into, they're going to fall into a combination of these or one of these categories. When we work with batterers, there's a whole bunch of more categories. And so I can't do this now, but if I were to open up the line and say, tell me what the impact of children is of living with a batterer, people would say all sorts of things, that they end up getting physically hurt themselves, that children end up with really traumatized kinds of experiences, they get depressed, if I were to ask you how do abusers use the children as part of their battering, you would say they manipulate the mother with the children. They oftentimes will hurt the children in order to hurt the woman. There's a lot of things that they're doing to actually use the children as part of battering her. And that form of that's a form of child abuse. When you use a child to batter a woman, that's a form of child abuse. It's not one that the only thing that the child protection workers are really trained to look at is there domestic violence? If there is, that ongoing domestic violence is in and of itself a form of neglect. What they're not trained so well to look at, and what's starting to happen now, is, well, what specifically is going on that is abusive to that child? And so this is where the new things, I mean, not new, these are the things that happen with a batterer and a child. And the first one is that they, too, will use excessive discipline. But if a batterer is doing that, they will often say to the mother, I want my child raised like this. I want you to do this. Sometimes they're actually saying to her, you're not disciplining the children enough. And so you'll see women getting more and more punitive towards their kids in order to sometimes to protect them from the father, but sometimes just to meet his demands. Sometimes it'll be out of the stress of living with him that they start to say to the kids, be quiet, and they're disciplining the kids that way. So you'll see a lot of her discipline of the children that's stemming from his pressure to raise them a certain way and to discipline them. Now, I do not want to act like women never abuse children unless a man makes them. That's not true. There's a lot of women who have very similar notions that men have about their wives, that she is mine, I have this right, in the hierarchy of things, I'm over her. There are women who take that same position with their children. You are my child, I have the right to hit you, I can hit you. And so I don't want to act like women don't, they do batter their children, they do physically abuse their children, less they don't sexually abuse their children as frequently as men might, but they do abuse their children separate from battering. I'm only talking now about the ways that a battered woman might participate in the physical chastisement of the child out of and part of the battering. The next thing that batterers do is they undermine the relationship of the mother with the children. And they do that in many ways. I just interviewed a woman last week that told me that she had met this man and really thought, oh, my God, this is it, this is it. And the more she got in a relationship with him and then she started to, you know, have a really serious relationship with him, she started to think he's too possessive, he's too this, he's too that. And then she decided, I'm going to end this relationship. And as soon as she made that decision to end that relationship, she found out she was pregnant. And she told him both things at once. I'm pregnant, and I don't think that I don't want to get married. They weren't living together. And so she was trying to get out of that relationship with him. And he just kept saying, that's my baby, and, you know, we can make this. And he just put so much pressure on her that she agreed to try to make it with him. And as soon as she had her baby, he started, actually, when she was in her 6th month of pregnancy, he started sexually abusing her. They started living together, right, you know, at like the 4th month. Then he started sexually abusing her, and right after the baby came home, within a month, she got pregnant again. And she talks in this interview, and this is a interview that people will have access to eventually, if you can, if you contact us at the end of the summer, because we're developing these materials. But in this interview, she talked about holding her baby, her first baby and her second baby, and both times looking down at this baby and praying, asking God to give her what it would take to love this baby. Because her first baby, the girl, because she had this baby, she now had to live with him, and he was abusing her, particularly sexually abusing her, and she felt trapped with him because she had this baby. And she had to force, she said, I had to push my love out for her and to get that. This is just a very important notion of interfering with the mother's relationship with the child. That she went on to talk about having to do this with her son, only it was harder because the son came from a rape. The son came from it looked like him. It was a double thing. I'll never get out of this now with him. And so again, she just prayed and prayed and prayed that she would find love for this baby. And so this idea of, and she did, by the way, but this idea that he's interfering with that relationship, this is an example of this particular woman's situation from birth. And the flip side of that is interfering with the child's relationship for the mother. You can interview an awful lot of teenage kids or kids that are, or not kids, but young adults whose mother stayed with the batterer for a long time, oftentimes for the sake of the children, who are so angry with her now. Why didn't you get me out of that? Why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? They're angry with her for his violence, and they're angry with her for, in their sense, choosing to stay with him. And yet, you know, I'm not going to go into all of the reasons why women are still there, but the anger that they have towards her for not stopping his violence, not being able to, picking him in the first place, et cetera, et cetera. That would be just one example of the way a batterer undermines the relationship of a child towards their mother. But there's a million ways that you all know, those of you who are out there listening to this, of ways that this relationship, her relationship with the child is undermined, and the child's relationship with her is undermined. The next one is the control and manipulation of women through her children. And, you know, if you don't do this, I'm going to take the kids. If you, you know, just a million different ways. Also getting the kids to, telling the kids, you know, your mom won't do this, your mom won't do that. Just all of these things that I think the people on the call, you could list dozens and dozens of the ways that he's able to manipulate her through the children. But a key factor here that I think is the most, the biggest thing that battered women face today in our court system and in this process of separating, particularly from abusers, is the idea that batterers do not typically allow women to have intimate relationships with other people, not their mother, not their sister. They don't allow intimate relationships with other people. They systematically cut those off, move her away from her parents, don't let her sister come around, make scenes with her best friend, come on to her best friend. All of those kind of intimate, close relationships she has with other people just gradually methodically sort of get broken off by an abuser. The most intimate relationship most women have is with their children. And abusers do not allow that either. And this is from the time the children of many, many abusers don't like her nursing. They will, when she's nursing, they will attack her on her breasts. I've got several police reports that show that he grabbed her by the breast, that she twisted her breast, that she slugged her in the breast while she was nursing. Many, many cases of him screaming at her when she's nursing to get that baby a bottle, to put, you know, to quit doing this, quit doing that. So this, it starts from a very, very early age of saying, this baby is not going to come before me, but also you're not going to have this bond with this baby that you're trying to do. Forget it. And so there's a separation of mother from their children and children from their mother that's very intense. I think the place that the people who see this the most, or they can, that have the most access to batterers, victims of battering, and children are visitation centers. They actually see this happen a lot, where oftentimes a man who's had very, very little contact with his children or very little nurturing of his children will go for custody of his children. And because of her, again, because of her economic situation of dependence on him, because of her mental instability, maybe her drinking, he's able to convince the court, look, I'm the more stable person, give me the kids. And the court will say, well, he beat her, he didn't beat the kids. He's more stable. They won't be homeless with him. They won't be, you know, the county's not going to pay for them. So he ends up with the kids, and now she's visiting at a visitation center. And then you'll see these constant ways of continuing to abuse her through the children at that visitation center. So this idea of separating mother from the children is a very, very big issue in advocacy for battered women today. when I was doing advocacy back in the 80s and early 90s, very few women were facing big custody battles that they were going to lose. Now, you know, if you're an advocate, you have to understand advocacy in the family court, because many women are facing losing their children as a part of his ongoing battering of her. Finally, the last one is that oftentimes they will hurt their partner through their children. And not very long ago, I watched a visitation of two teenage daughters with their children, and they never talked to their mother. And this is the sixth week in a row they've been sitting in this room with this woman and just would not talk to her. And she kept saying, she was talking about the last time that they saw her. She hit him, and she got arrested. But it was after years and years of abuse. She got arrested. He got a temporary protection order, and she's still in the process now of trying to get her kids back. In the meantime, they're just being completely filled with this idea that your mother hates you, your mother this, your mother that. And when they finally were able to get off with these kids and talk to them, the kinds of things that he was saying and doing and telling them about her was just absolutely turning them on her. And so this idea of hurting her through the children is a very, very real thing. And finally, they hurt the partner by hurting the children. Of course, the extreme of that we read in the paper, every few months you pick up the paper and you read about someone who just killed two kids or killed three kids or got his first visit and then shot the kids. And there's just a case in Baltimore, two cases out east that happened in the last month that were just ugly, ugly cases of, I will kill these kids and you will spend the rest of your life wishing you hadn't left me or wishing that you hadn't done me wrong. And so this idea of hurting her through the children can be very, very extreme, and I would say oftentimes is, in that it often comes out in the form of sexual abuse of the children. It often comes out in the form of severe emotional abuse of the children in order to teach her a lesson. So these forms of child abuse is something that in the battered women's movement we haven't, we've said a lot that children suffer, we've raised these issues, but we haven't really set up a form of advocacy for children. We haven't made visible these particular forms of abuse in the court in a way that that would counter this new kind of wave of people being able to get custody away from battered women. So I think it's the biggest challenge for the battered women's movement today is to deal with the kind of discourse change that has to happen in our court system to see this, to make, again, justice, to make this visible, to correct this wrong, and to undo the harm that's been done, or to at least try to repair the harm that's been done. So I want to play a little transcript of a tape now, Liz, if you can do that. And you've got a, does everyone have a script there with them?
They do.
This is a 911 tape. I want you to keep in mind what I was just saying about this is a guy who called in. Now, this is a he said, she said, low-level misdemeanor assault. I want you to hear the emotion in it, the pain in this call, and no one's going to get hurt really badly, I'll tell you that. But at one point during this call, the guy slugs the woman in the back and she drops the phone and a 10-year-old girl picks it up. I don't know how well you'll be able to hear in this phone system we have. That's why we have the transcript in front of you. But mostly I want you to hear how she's talking and what he's saying and some of the kind of what this event, which is a typical event in a battering, a home where a guy is battering. This is not a really unusual kind of thing. And to think about what it's like to raise a child with this kind of stuff going on. So go ahead and listen, play this, huh?
Sure. The recording is about 3 minutes, 30 seconds.
I cannot understand you. 404? What is the address?
4408.
Okay. And what is your name? Is there any weapons?
No.
Okay, is there any way that you can get away from him?
No. I have a 12-month-old baby and a 10-year-old daughter who's threatening us all. Please hurry.
Hold
on a second.
Oh, that's where he just hit her.
Is there any other kids in the house?
Hello?
Who is this? This is the 911 operator. Are you at 4408?
Yeah, and, my stepdad, something, and now he's, trying to kill us.
Okay. Does he have any weapons?
No.
Okay.
But can you just call me, please?
Okay, honey, I'm getting someone on the way, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Wait, don't hang up on me. Don't hang up on me, okay? I need to keep you on the phone.
Okay.
And it's 4408, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Is this your dad?
It's my stepdad.
Your stepdad? Honey, they're on the way, okay? I just need for you to stay on the line. Can you tell me your phone number?
Play that tape because I the first time I listened to it, I just thought, oh my God, this little girl, you know, to have this man standing over here and saying, you can have your child, I don't want her, I don't want anything to do with her, I just want my son, and then to know the chances are she's going to be living with him in the next year, and what that must be like for her to go to school the next day, and what it does to her relationship with her mother and her 11-month-old brother, who he says, this is the only thing I want from our relationship is my son. This is my son, and then later on, you don't hear this, but he says, if you think, don't you ever think that you're taking my son. So he's basically telling her, if she leaves him, she's got to leave the son behind. And the little girl, if you look at her relationship, what this scene does with her mother, what it does in terms of her mother towards her, her towards her mother, her towards her stepfather, her towards her brother. Every relationship in that family is affected by this scene, but this scene probably happens over and over and over again. This is not an event. This is part of many events in which you know that this is not the first time this guy's ever done this. He says, call the police, get him over here, show him this. He's not at all afraid that he's just slugged this woman in the back. He's not at all afraid that anything's going to happen to him. And so I think that this is the kind of thing that I was talking about, is this entitlement that he has to just blow up in this house and cause everyone to be crying. His 11-month-old son, his stepdaughter, his wife, everyone is now shaking as he romps around the house and has his say about things. And then in the end of this thing, he says, go ahead, call the police. And when the police come out, because there's no physical injury, they don't hear this tape, they don't interview the girl, they basically write a report that said, He said that she hit her. There's no physical injury. He said, she said, they write up the report and they leave. And so I'm not criticizing the police. I'm just saying that this is a minor domestic violence case. And look at the trauma that you can imagine that this one event tied to many, many, many events caused those children and that woman. And you also see right away he's saying, this is my son. This is all I want. This is what I'm going to get. If you leave, you're going to pick between your daughter and your son, or you're going to stay here with me and you're going to have all of us. That's kind of the choice that this woman is going to be given here. So that's what I have to say about all of this. We have 2 minutes left, and I have a list here of things that you can practically do to make all of these adjustments around protection orders, arraignment court, police deferral. I think what I'll do is I'll write an email and send it to Liz about some of the points that I was going to make about making adjustments that can go out to people. But I want to thank everyone for being on and open up the line one more time if anyone has a question or a comment that you'd like to make before we end. Megan, do you want to open up the line?
Sure. At this time, if you have a question or a comment, please press the number 1 once on your touchtone phone. All questions will be answered in the order that they are received. And I don't see anyone popping into the queue just yet.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there's one. It comes from Nicole in New Hampshire. Nicole, your line is now open.
Hi, Nicole.
Yes, hi. I just had a question. The things that you're talking about are quite familiar, you know, in the work that I do as an advocate. And I'm wondering, oftentimes we have trouble when a mother goes to court and there's mental health accusations and there's been all this disruption through the batter. And oftentimes the mother doesn't seem to have much voice. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are regarding expert testimony, which is very hard to come by. But do you see that as valuable, or do you see that as, in a certain way, undermining the mother's ability to present her own circumstance as an expert?
No, because I don't think that she's considered an expert by the court, and it's the court who's making the decision. And I do think that we need to have quite a few people in a local community that can step forward and put context into all of this and explain some of the things that maybe she, you know, we're not really undermining her autonomy by saying, look, do you want a person to testify in your case that can say these kinds of things? That's really giving a resource to her. She can always decide she doesn't, with her lawyer, she doesn't want that expert testimony. But I think, you know, getting people who can come forward, and, you know, like, justice means that the truth is part of the process. And the way that the court system works now is that the two attorneys present material, and there isn't anybody to put all that in context often. And so the truth doesn't really come out about these things. You know, her mental health condition all of a sudden becomes the reason the kids shouldn't be with her. And the idea that this is all a function of the battering and abuse that she's experienced becomes kind of invisible in the courtroom. So you want to make all that stuff come out. Now, unfortunately, the court isn't there to decide in divorce cases or separation or custody and access. It's so funny that it's narrowly kind of saying what's in the best interest of the children. And in our court system today, economic security, because we don't have economic security for her or her children if he's not there, then he can provide things she can't. He can provide a house, he can provide this, he can provide that. And so the court looks at that, and it's not that they don't see the domestic violence, it's that the domestic violence doesn't override the idea that he can provide a more stable household because he's got the money, or because right now he's not, in a sense, oftentimes women, right at the time they're going to court is when their life is most falling apart. Oftentimes they're using alcohol or drugs and self-medicating, and they have a very difficult time getting through those 18 months after the separation, and that's when he's going after those kids. So I think, no, you really want to provide as many resources for her in that courtroom as you can to let that stuff come out and be seen. She'll love you for being the voice that way. So, Okay, there we are, everyone. Thank you very much for getting on. And if you've got any kind of questions that still linger on from this, you can email liz@praxisinternational.org. Any last things, Liz, that you need to say?
No, just thanks, everyone, for participating. Thanks very much to you, Ellen, for the two parts of the series. And please just be sure to return your evaluation to us, because we really appreciate and need your feedback.
Thanks, everyone. Goodbye.